cowboys went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plow through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
This is Dan Kimmler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we will be reading from two 1930s vintage cowboy pulp magazines. Our first story is from Cowboy Short Stories, published by Blue Ribbon Magazines in November 1939. And before we begin, I remind you that our stories are often edited for recording. Our first tale is Spawn of the Gun Lobo by Eric Thane. He wasted no time. He dropped from the saddle and charged across the street. Instinct told him that no killer had fired the shot, and he saw when he rounded the corner of a store that he was right. A kid in his early teens scrambled in retreat through the weeds of a vacant lot. "Hey there," Frayne called. "Halt." At the harsh steel in his voice, the youngster froze with defiant fear. He trembled, but snarled like some animal when Frayne seized his arm and shook him. "See here, kid, what's the idea of trying to kill me?"
Callan told me to."
Frayne stiffened. Callan. The name held a familiar ring. Frayne's eyes gleamed. He remembered. Callan's name had been in the letter he'd got from the mayor of Selby. Callan and Hardell. The men whom Tombstone Frayne had come north from Arizona to drive out of Selby or kill. He muttered to himself, "So that's the kind of coyotes they are. Sick a kid on me to do their dirty work. Well, Callan and Hardell, we'll see." He was suddenly tired of all this death and dangerous life which made up his profession. He was giving up after this one last job, this task of cleaning up Selby. He'd store away his gun for good. He'd lost his taste for the wild music of gunplay. The country was changing. Organized law had entered, and Tombstone Frayne was one of the old order that settled with powder and steel. He pushed the kid forward and grunted, "Better wait a few years before you try gunning." He was turning away, conscious of the ache which cried for rest in a soft bed, when running footsteps jerked him alert. He spun, tensing like a steel rod. A girl darted through the weeds and was sobbing against the kid's head, which she'd drawn to her breast. A young, slender girl, vivid with life. Frayne glimpsed her eyes, shiny through tears. The kid's sister, he thought. Those eyes pierced him, pleaded. She'd seen what had happened. Her voice shook.
"Oh, please, he didn't mean it. Honestly, he didn't."
"A lead slug ain't easy to swaller, and I came blame near swallering one," Frayne commented dryly.
"But, sir, it's all Callan's fault."
Her cheeks flamed in anger.
I'd like to kill him."
Frayne's dry, hard voice remarked. "That's why I'm here, so don't you bother yourself."
"Are you Tombstone Frayne?"
Her eyes searched his face, seeking confirmation of some hope.
"Are you the man the mayor hired to clean up Selby?"
"Never reckon I am, ma'am."
"I'm Lois Thompson. I teach school."
She took a step forward to Frayne. She was small. Her head came scarcely to the knot that held the dusty neckerchief around his throat. The trust roused in her eyes caused the Arizona man's pulse to throb with excitement, an emotion that not even danger could rouse in him. No person had ever put the faith in him which she seemed to do.
"I'm so glad you're Frayne. I was afraid you'd be like those other men the mayor got up here. Brutes who didn't think of a thing but their guns and earning money. Two of them hired out to Callan and Hardell after the mayor had called them in."
"And what happened to the others?" Frayne asked. He saw fear leap into her eyes. Her cheeks whitened.
"They're dead," she whispered.
Her hand came forward. Frayne felt it quiver against his arm.
"You won't let them kill you, will you?"
Frayne spoke in his hard, level voice. "This is my last job. I'm quitting, settling down. I don't want to get killed right now. I am to run them skunks out of town.
But if they won't run, I aim to kill 'em. I'll get them like I got the others, let 'em draw first, and then smear 'em out." He said it simply. He scarcely knew what he said. His voice was a faraway drone. The exhilaration of the girl's interest in him was running like alcohol through his veins. He knew why he was weary of the life he led. He wanted things that didn't go with death and killing. Foremost among them was the love of a woman. "You don't look too good to me," the boy Jack cut in. "I reckon Callan will polish you off as if you was never here." "You see," Lois Thompson whispered, "Callan's his hero. He's the hero of every boy in school. They worship Callan because he's wild and irresponsible. Everything a good man shouldn't be. If something isn't done, those boys will grow up to be like Callan."
"I reckon Jack's got a good start headed for the Owl Hoot," Frayne admitted. He addressed the boy. "So you don't think much of me?"
"No, I don't. I'm put out that I didn't kill you. Callan had patted me on the back."
He ignored his sister's horror.
"I reckon you're the next who'll be going to Boot Hill. There ain't nobody in the world as good with a gun as Callan."
He spat importantly and stalked away. Frayne turned to Lois.
You see why we're so anxious to clean up the town," her voice quivering. "It's bad enough when the desperados ruin grown-ups, but when they start in on the children, that's 1,000 times worse. A great many men here admire Callan, too. Some of them are in with him. Nobody knows who they are, so the honest men are afraid of vigilantes. They might include a spy, and Callan's men would wipe them out like the murderers they are."
"How about the sheriff?" Frayne asked.
"We have no sheriff. Nobody will run. Even if they did, Callan would see they didn't remain a lawman long. It's desperate, Mr. Frayne. If something isn't done, this town will become altogether outlaw, and the few decent people will have to leave. And my brother Jack, he'll become an outlaw."
Frayne's face was emotionless. Lois looked at him, striving to read his thoughts. The somber hardness of his jaw frightened her. "Don't worry, ma'am," was all he said. He was upon the point of saying more, some other word of comfort, when a horseman rode up. A red-faced man in his middle age, a fighter, Frayne divined by the tight line of his jaw.
"Tombstone Frayne, welcome to Montana and to Selby. I'm Mayor Thompson." He spoke with a soft accent that branded him a Texas man. His look swept to Lois. "What are you doing here, cousin? Hadn't you be back in the schoolroom?"
"Jack played hooky today, and I was looking for him. He laid for Mr. Frayne and tried to shoot him. Callan put him up to it."
Frayne saw rage in the mayor's face. "Run along now," he directed. "I'll see to Mr. Frayne." The girl left. She looked back at Frayne's face. Even at the distance, Frayne could see the flash of her eyes. It was seconds before he caught the thread of Mayor Thompson's conversation.
"And the railroad wants to build, but are afraid the roughs might wreck the station and do other damage. So we sent down to Arizona for you. Callan and Hardell are the main desperados. The rest are toadies, and with Callan and Hardell out of the way, the town would be all right. It'd be safe for the railroad. If things ain't tamed down, they aim to build their line 50 miles north, around Gold Butte. Figure you can handle things?"
"Always have," Frayne returned laconically.
"Your reputation seems that away, Mr. Frayne. I understand you got plenty of outlaw notches in your gun."
"I'm settling down after this job. Got a ranch in Arizona I'm paying on. With the money I get from this job, I'll be able to put my full time in on that ranch. Got a mortgage big enough to choke a horse, but I can work that off. And with any luck and a good calf crop, I reckon after this job, I'm hanging up my guns for good."
"Marion, maybe," suggested the mayor. "We have some nice girls around Selby. Or maybe you're already harnessed."
"Nope. Still roving with the wild bunch, but I aim to get married sometime." He added under his breath, "And maybe I've found the girl."
"Well, good luck to you. Be mighty careful, though. We don't want Boot Hill's bells ringing before wedding bells."
The mayor left after directing Frayne to the hotel. Frayne located the sheriff's long-disused office, went in and dusted off the chair. He threw himself wearily into it and thought. He knew we should be planning blood and death, but he thought of the little black-eyed schoolteacher. Evidently, she was the mayor's cousin. She was certainly beautiful and interested in him. His heart accelerated. That ranch down home needed a missus. He dreamed for a time, then decided to go to the hotel and get some sleep. The hot, dusty street slept under the heat of mid-afternoon. Before the Northern Hotel was a knot of men who eyed him curiously, without hostility or friendliness. He was about to enter the door when a whoop halted him. Down the street came a dozen boys. Evidently, school was just dismissed. The leader was Jack Thompson. Frayne thought of Lois. The girl thought the world of her brother, and Callan's influence over the lad hurt her keenly. Frayne's lips tightened. He'd remove that influence. His hand dropped by instinct to the gun that hung in a stripped-down holster strapped to hip and thigh, the holster that made men eye him warily when they first saw him. Jack sighted him. "There he is, fellers! The man who thinks he's as good as Callan!" He shook his fist and screamed. "I tried to kill him, but I didn't. But Callan'll get him." The boys came close to Frayne and swore at him. One of the boldest, lifting a rock from the dust, hurled it forward. It splintered the wall close to Frayne's elbow. He stepped inside, quickly. Strange that he should be breathing hard. The taunts and hatred of men he was used to. But children were different. What a fiendish influence this man Callan had. The clerk directed him to his room and promised to take care of his horse. Frayne went wearily up the stairs and found his room. The door was ajar. Frayne went in. Fatigue weighted him like some physical force. This, his last job, was going to be his hardest. But what if it were not his last job? What if hard times on his ranch forced him to kill again? He stripped off his cartridge belt and neckerchief. He noticed a sack lying on the table. Curiously, he opened it and peered inside. The yellow of golden double eagles leaped out to stun him. "Like them, Frayne?" His cougar-lithe muscles lifting him lightly, Frayne spun to face the man concealed in a clothes closet. A heavy-set man, not villainous appearing, but with a cruelty and hardness in his eyes. A gun dangled from his fingers. He stepped slowly forward. "Like them, Frayne?" he repeated. "There's $10,000 in that sack. Enough to buy that ranch of yours, lift the mortgage, and keep you in comfort the rest of your days." "What do you know about my ranch and my mortgage?" Frayne asked. He didn't need to ask the other's name. He knew it instinctively. Callan. "Matter of luck. I was standing close to the store where you and Lois Thompson and the mayor were gassing. I picked up a few words." He spoke in a crisp voice that held none of the desperado. He didn't look the part. He might have been a businessman, but his eyes were the rolling eyes of a wolf, of a man desperately bad. Frayne read them and knew the man for what he was. "Your gun is too far away, I reckon, so I'll put mine up," he said, holstering his weapon. He smiled a thin, humorless smile that deepened the wolf lines about his mouth. "Now listen, Tombstone Frayne, I've got a proposition. There's $10,000 on that table. It's for you if you listen." "What does that mean?" Frayne asked cautiously. He wasn't surprised. Long ago he'd got over the emotion. Death, disappointment, the swift change of events. He'd expected something like this, ever since the girl had mentioned that lawmen had been bought off. "Just this, Frayne. We don't have any quarrel with you, and you've got no quarrel with us. You're just doing your job. You're here to earn some money. Your business is to drive us out of town or kill us. I'm raising the ante. I'm offering you 10 times what Selby has given you. I'm offering it to you to get you out of town and leave us alone." "Afraid of me?" Frayne asked. "Maybe, maybe not. We know your reputation. Of all the gunmen who've stood up to me, you'd come closest out shooting me. But I'm a businessman, Frayne, and gambling in this town makes me plenty of money. You're gumming up things.
Better take that money and hightail south.
And my job here?
The outlaw exclaimed impatiently, I'm offering you 10 times what Selby'll give you.
And if I don't take it?
Cruelty leaped into Callan's eyes. There were a couple of hombres before who wouldn't listen to sense, he remarked softly. I reckon they ain't findin' Boot Hill too comfortable.
Frayne went to the window and stared west, where the Rockies jutted like purple saw teeth above the horizon. The weariness of his body and soul tugged him down. $10,000 for riding away. No gunfight, no looking into the face of death, no unpleasantness. Just $10,000. Enough to pay for his ranch, to lift the mortgage, to build up a herd sufficient for the rest of his life. He could hang up his guns for good. No more of that last sickening instant when he drew, to kill or be killed. The one moment in all this bloody business which he hated. The moment he put off long as he could, until his opponent forced his hand. No more of that. But there was Lois, the first woman in whom he'd ever been interested. He was opening his mouth to refuse the offer when Callan, as if reading his thoughts, said, And while I'm thinking about it, Frayne, don't let that little schoolteacher keep you here. Lois Thompson is going to marry Colonel James. He's worth millions. If she give you any encouragement today, just remember she's marrying him for his money.
Frayne seemed suddenly dead. He numbed to the sensation of drunkenness, to despair. He heard himself laugh queerly. He'd heard of the James spread. And he'd imagined Lois Thompson as the mistress of his little two-bit spread in Arizona. $10,000 in golden double eagles. All right, he heard his voice grit out in faraway tones. I'm taking the gold and going. And right now, Callan persisted. Right now. Have my horse brought round.
He found himself in the street in the dusk. He must have walked down the stairs, but he hadn't felt them under his boots. Out here reality assailed him. His horse appeared, and a man strode up at whom Callan waved. This is my pard, Hardell.
Frayne acknowledged the man's curt, howdy, and gave Selby a last look. There were people on the streets, watching him curiously. Suddenly it came to him that they knew what was happening. Contempt was in their faces. But $10,000 was a lot of money.
Yeah, scared out. What'd I tell you?
It was the boy, Jack. Frayne twisted in the saddle and looked into the kid's jeering face. Other boys behind him now shouted, Scared out. I told you Callan was too good for you law and order men, Jack yelped. Frayne's mind moved slowly. Lois loved Jack. It hurt her to think that he patterned his life after the lawless. She pinned her faith on the gunman from Arizona, and now the gunman was leaving. Jack would grow to be an outlaw unless Callan was blotted out of the picture. Frayne took a deep breath. It didn't matter much that Lois would never be the mistress of his Arizona ranch. What mattered was that the old order which Callan and Hardell personified was vanishing. In the new order, young gunmen, like Jack, would most certainly be blotted out of the picture quickly, and Lois loved Jack. Tombstone Frayne spun his horse by short rein. He flung the bag of money into the dust before Callan's mount.
Listen, Callan and Hardell, he ordered in his cold, deadly voice. I'm the special marshal of Selby, and I'm warning you two to be out of town by 12 o'clock. Tonight. Pack and get.
So you changed your mind, eh?
Hardell questioned. Some throat ailment diminished his voice to a hoarse but deadly whisper.
You heard me? Out of town by 12 o'clock. If you're still here, I'm using lead force. I'll wait in my room, and on the stroke of 12 I start looking for you.
Callan dismounted and picked up the bag. He didn't raise his eyes or his voice, but his words were sharp as a pistol shot. At 12 o'clock, Frayne, Hardell and I will be in the northern bar down the street, and we'll be waiting for you.
Frayne watched the hands of the clock, dimly illuminated by the light of a smoky kerosene lamp, creep towards 12. With 20 minutes to go, he began to inspect his gun.
At 10 minutes to go, he got slowly to his feet, strapped the holster about his hips, and thrust the dully gleaming .45 into it. He tried his hand a couple of times and was satisfied with his lightning draw. Until this moment, he'd been icy cold and emotionless. But now, with the ivory butt cuddled in his palm and the hands of the clock meeting towards midnight, he felt the thrill of the killer. His breath shortened. His heart tumbled wildly. But he did not permit it to grip him. Outwardly, nothing appeared. This man with the half-closed eyes was a hard statue of granite without feeling of any sort, which was the reputation by which the lawless knew him, and a reputation he'd uphold within the next few minutes. He went downstairs into the moonlit night. There was a barrel of water and a dipper near the door. He drank deeply to cool the fire that had roused in him. Flame jumped through his veins. He calmed himself with the realization that this was his job. Killing of outlaws after he'd warned them. There must be none of the killer lust within him. He shot to uphold law and order. After that, he strode along as unconcernedly as a man going to his daily work. But the steps that followed him weren't unconcerned. They pattered nervously along the boardwalk and came to a halt beside Frayne. Lois! The moonlight touched her cheeks and hair and her slender body. Something within Frayne shook at her beauty and the fact that she could never be his.
"Oh, Frayne, I heard about you. Callan's been bragging. Are you going down to the Northern and shoot it out with him?"
"That's what I'm contracted to do," Frayne said harshly.
"Please, Frayne, be careful. Callan is a killer."
"So am I," Frayne reminded her.
"Frayne, it was wonderful of you to refuse that bribe."
Frayne said nothing. He couldn't. Some force tugged at his throat and muted him. He walked on, ignoring her and never looking back. Presently, her footsteps followed him no more. Then Frayne ventured to glance back. The empty, moonlit street made him feel queer inside. He went swiftly to the Northern and crashed open the swinging doors. He was unnecessarily violent, for the killer rage had roused, and he wanted to diminish it with a show of physical force before the final gun flame showdown. Inside the bar, the place was hushed and strained. The card tables were empty, with the men gathered at the bar. Frayne saw why, and his lips were touched by a grim grin. The way to a swift retreat was open from the bar. Behind the mahogany top, the keeper was swabbing glasses nervously. His eyes jerked when Frayne entered. He didn't want to appear nervous, and he began to sing softly, a tune which lifted above the subdued hum of half-whispering men. "The grass of old Montani is green as can be." The words froze in his throat when Frayne, stepping to a place magically cleared for him at the bar, ordered a drink.
Yes, sir, Mr. Frayne, coming up."
Frayne faced the room. He saw nothing of Callan or the whispering Hardell. But the eyes of many men were hostile, their faces contorted with hatred. Frayne swept them indifferently. He knew the breed, and he knew that once he had killed Callan and Hardell, these men would be as faithful to his law and order as they had been to the outlaws' disorder and crookedness. "Any of you hombres seen Callan and Hardell?" he inquired. "I'm the special police officer here. I give them 2 hombres till 12 to pack out of town. It's 12 now." When no man vouchsafed an answer, he turned to the barkeep. That individual seemed almost in a faint, but mustered enough energy to pipe,
"No, sir, no, sir, I ain't seen 'em."
"I reckon maybe they left town then?" Frayne pursued.
I couldn't rightly say."
The man's lips froze. His eyes stared with peculiar affright past Frayne's head. The men at the bar began edging away. Frayne laughed. He was cold as ice, with the killer lust gone, filled only with his desire to have a disagreeable job over with. He knew what was happening. Callan and Hardell, hidden in a back room, were advancing on him from behind. "Your liquor is good, barkeep. Seeing as how I'm the special peace officer here, I reckon I ready to drink free, eh?" He leaned over, the bar top hard against his stomach, and poked the keeper in the chest. The man leaped as if shot. Nervous, barkeep? Take my advice and sleep more. Sleep will settle the nerves.
A long sleep is gonna settle your nerves for good, Callan's soft voice purred behind him.
Frayn spun in exaggerated surprise.
Callan, I didn't figure to see you, he ejaculated. I figured you and Hardell would be out of town.
Jolly, ain't ya?
Hardell whispered. He was behind Callan and to one side. His eyes were harsh, compared with the bland but dangerous gleam in his leader's coyote look.
Well, well, Frayn permitted a thin, hard smile to ripple along his lips. I don't aim to spread sweetness and light, but I am to get on the best I can.
Then suddenly his voice jerked like the lash of a black snake. I told you and Callan to be out of town by 12.
And I said, Callan reminded him softly, that I'd be here at 12.
Frayn was acting as he'd acted before, a prelude to gunsmoke and lead. He said,
you boys are plumb tough about it, ain't ya? I just ask you peaceable to leave town, and now you get nasty.
Maybe we'd better just invite you to leave town, Callan suggested.
Ain't you boys uppity mavericks, Frayn jeered. You can't be serious. Don't you remember it was me ordered you to leave town?
He pushed himself away from the bar with his elbows. He took 3 apparently aimless steps to the left, placing distance between himself and the 2 men. A sinister movement. The onlookers recognized it, scattered, and the barkeep ducked.
So you boys are intent on staying? Frayn said.
Callan stiffened, an imperceptible tensing of muscles that presaged explosive action. His fingers twitched. It wouldn't be long now. In a second, Callan would draw.
Then it occurred to the Arizona man that he might be killed.
It had always been thus. No thought of self until this last moment. And then, a momentary dread, a brief vision of himself lying silent on the floor, tormented him. Visions and thoughts that vanished in a merciless rage that found climax in a throb of guns. Never taking his eyes from the 2, his fingers fumbled for tobacco and cigarette papers. He rolled a white cylinder, ran his tongue along the edge, and with his left hand groped for a match. In his right, he held the cigarette, steady chest high above the butt of his gun. Failing to find a match, he withdrew his fingers and held them out.
I'm needing a match. Got one, Callan?
The man snarled, his soft voice for once breaking.
I wouldn't give you anything, Frayn. Hell, what are we standing here for? You ordered us out of town. What do you aim to do?
Nothing, Frayn returned. Just stand here and wait for a match. Until you crack and go for your gun. Then I'll kill you.
Callan seemed to freeze, but his fingers twitched with a slow, water-rippling motion. Behind him, Hardell tensed.
Better wait until your boss draws, Frayn jeered.
Damn you, Frayn! I'll kill you!
Callan screamed, breaking suddenly. His hand dropped, came up, flaming. Frayn waited the fraction of a second which in the coroner's verdict would give him the judgment of self-defense. Then his hand dipped, the cigarette spilled to the floor, while the hand that held it straightened out to balance the other hand that drew a gun with the speed of light. Frayn felt the cold grip against his palm, felt the hard metal of the fanning hammer under the ball of his thumb. He heard the boom of Callan's weapon and the hiss of lead close by. Then his thumb lifted from the hammer, and his gun thundered with the voice of doom. Not once, but 3 times, the shots one continuous roar. Callan reeled and shook. His knees wavered, but he held himself erect. His eyes gleamed the pale yellow of some desperate animal. Suddenly, his face contorted. A hand clutched his throat, and he toppled forward. But not dead yet. He writhed and twisted over on his back. Frayn turned his attention to Hardell. The whispering man had held his fire, but now opened up. He used both hands to fan his weapon, left fingers on the grip, right palm sweeping back the hammer. He was appallingly fast. Then Frayn unleashed his own weapon and fanned until the gun was empty. Hardell took a step forward. He turned to stone. His finger froze on the trigger.
His mouth opened in a ghastly expression of surprise. His eyes wavered, then focused in death. He crumpled to his knees. His gun clattered with a steely sound along the floor. For an instant, he held himself upright on hands and knees, then flattened out, chin against the floor. A wave of red seethed from under him. "And that's another job," Frayne exulted. But in victory, his caution didn't desert him. He turned back to Callan just in time. The man, in the last moment before death, raised his gun. It exploded. White flame seemed to tear through Frayne. He reeled. He thumbed his gun, but the hammer smashed on empty cylinders. Another shot wasn't necessary. Callan's shot had been his death act. He settled back, and his eyes focused into the same death stare as his partner's. Frayne was conscious of blood in his throat, dripping from his chin. The room began to spin about him and blacken. He heard himself gurgle out, "That's the end," and then the darkening floor leaped up to meet him. He awoke to a white bed and a nurse bending over him. There was an excited mumble he didn't place until he turned on his side and saw a bunch of kids staring at him with awe. It was the bunch that had jeered him. There was genuine admiration in their eyes. Jack Thompson stepped forward. He held a flower, which he shoved at Frayne. His eyes were big and round. "Gee, Mr. Frayne, you're good. A lot better than Callan. I bet all you men who uphold the law are better than Callan. I'm going to be a sheriff when I grow up." "Hey, fellas," he called, "we're all going to be sheriffs when we grow up, ain't we?" They chorused assent. "You better go," the nurse said and forced them out. Then, "Another visitor," she announced, and left. It was Lois. She came to Frayne's side at once, and her look stirred him. "The boys are all changed," she said. "You are Jack's hero. Those boys are saved. They'll admire the law now, not the outlaw."
I reckon that's good," Frayne stammered. He didn't particularly want to be thanked. He was being paid to do his work.
"Frayne," Lois whispered, coming very close, "you are delirious. You said something about Colonel James."
"Callan told me you was going to marry him."
"That's another of Callan's lies. I'm not going to marry him. He's nice to me, but I'm not going to marry him."
Frayne smiled. Suddenly everything was peaceful, and he was comfortable. No need to tell Lois what Callan's lie had almost done. That was in the past. For the present, he heard the sound of the boys playing in the street. He looked at Lois, and his grin widened. They'd make a good bunch to uphold law and order when they grew to be men. And that was Spawn of the Gun Lobo by Eric Thane. Our other story today is from Street & Smith's Western Story Magazine of June 3, 1939, and this one is entitled Broken Wilderness Truce by Kenneth Gilbert. Jim Lawson came awake at his little camp in the forest with sudden agonizing effort and a nightmarish feeling that somebody had him by the throat. His thoughts flew to Bart Slade, the killer on whose trail he had clung for nearly 3 weeks through the high country. Gasping for breath, he struggled into full wakefulness. The unseen hands relaxed, and Lawson realized that they didn't belong to Bart Slade. As the sleep-drenched brain of the deputy cleared, he sat up abruptly and looked around. What had been peaceful gloom at sundown was now a flickering glow, weird and unreal. In a half-circle, tightening swiftly, was a leaping line of red shapes like painted bodies rising and falling in the orgies of a death dance. Forest fire! It was the choking smoke that had roused him, not the deadly grip of Bart Slade's steely fingers. Driven by a gusty south wind, the jaws of the flame trap were closing rapidly. In the mocking wind and the spiteful crackle of fire, it seemed to Jim Lawson that he could hear Bart Slade's malevolent chuckle. This onrushing blaze could scarcely be a coincidence. It was too sudden, and it covered such a front that it must have been started in several places. Slade must have touched off the tinder dry woods in the hope that if the deputy did not perish outright, he would at least be delayed long enough for the outlaw to escape.
"Didn't think he was that smart," Lawson told himself gloomily, while his mind came to grips with the problem of saving his own life. It was bitter to admit, but he was licked. Son of a gun must have figured this long ago. Waited till I got close, then set her afire. He'll get 2-3 days' start now. These woods'll be too hot for me to travel, even if I do get out. It was a disappointment more deeply personal than official. He wanted Slade dead or alive. Since the day that the outlaw had broken jail at Bear Paw after killing the sheriff, kindly old Pete Drain, the deputy had become a grim nemesis, for Pete Drain had been like a father to him. Slade had shot down the old officer, giving him no chance. Retribution had become a matter of urgent necessity. Bear Paw volunteers formed a posse, but Jim wanted no help. He put oil on his gun and set out alone. Because he was mountain bred and knew the ways of the wilderness, and Slade was no true hillman, but a hanger-on of the settlements, the result seemed certain. Only hours behind now, Lawson had counted on a reckoning soon after daylight. But he had underrated Slade. The man was more cunning than he had believed. Slade's putting a blazing barrier behind him was something Lawson had failed to anticipate. Lawson realized that if he lived, he'd have to go back to Bear Paw and confess defeat. But the chances of getting out of this flame trap alive were nil. The wind was strong, and the brush burned like dry hay. Only seconds had elapsed since he awakened, but escape seemed cut off. There was only one course to take: run before the fire, and trust to luck. Something zoomed past his head like a bullet. He caught a glimpse of a brown feathered body. Grouse! The bird darted to freedom before the rolling pall of smoke, but it seemed confused, for it circled back in bewildered fashion, then dived into that advancing wall of flame. Lawson winced as he contemplated that dread moment of agony before death. Maybe he, too, would feel it. There was a light thudding of feet, a whistling snort of alarm, and Lawson stopped involuntarily. He saw a young black-tailed doe, her half-grown fawn beside her, so close that Lawson could have touched her muzzle. The doe's eyes were rolling in terror, and the deputy saw that the searing finger of death had brushed the fawn, for there was a hairless patch on the flank, and the tender flesh was livid. The fear-stricken baby made a mewling sound of protest at the pain and weaved unsteadily on slender legs, but when his mother started off again, he staggered after her. Poor little devil, Lawson thought. Slade had done this, and if it were possible for Jim Lawson to feel greater resentment toward the man who had killed old Pete Drain, he felt it now. There was a crash of brush, and the woods shook wildly as a black bear lumbered past. The bear gave only a fleeting glance from its reddened, piggish eyes. Greater than awe of any two-legged enemy was its fear of the red death that rode the wings of the wind. At that moment, Lawson saw why the grouse had wheeled and come back to its doom. Just ahead was a line of fire. The befuddled bird had assumed that the ring of death was complete. That was why it had gone headlong back in the direction whence it had come. The man's throat tightened suddenly in apprehension. The wind had driven a wedge of flame on each side of him, and the points of those wedges had come together. But the pair of deer and the bear had not returned. Lawson's wood sense told him that they had managed to get through. Even while he hesitated, other critters streamed by him. Frightened rabbits, a black-tailed buck, a scuttling figure which he knew to be a gray fox. There must be a way out. At top speed, he raced after them. Then he remembered. Less than a half mile ahead was a little wilderness lake. He had passed it late that afternoon. The wild things were seeking water, their only refuge. Lawson clung to his short-barreled carbine. The gun impeded his progress, but he was reluctant to throw it away. Before he reached the lake shore, the fire nearly caught him. He broke through the brush, beginning to smoke in the intense heat, and fell with a splash into the cool water. For a long minute he lay there, drawing in gasping breaths of the fresher air which was close to the surface. With a vast sweep, the fire came down to the water's edge and licked up the dry reeds as though expecting to find Lawson hiding in them.
All about him were splashings that he knew were made by forest creatures who had also gained sanctuary. The air grew hotter as the burning brush ignited dead trees. It came to Lawson that he had merely been reprieved from death. He would either be suffocated by smoke or blistered by the flames unless he could get away from shore. But although Lawson was a good swimmer, the water had the chill of ice, and if he tried paddling to the center of the lake, he would probably take a cramp and drown. Where had the fleeing animals gone? That question kept dinning away in Lawson's brain. They knew what they were doing. It might be that the fire had not yet reached the other shore. If he could swim across the lake, he might still escape. But he couldn't do it burdened with his gun. He had to decide quickly. Lawson unlaced his boots and pulled them off. Then he waded in closer to shore and poked along the bank until he found a hole, probably made by a burrowing muskrat. Into this he thrust his boots and gun, coat, and outer shirt. Guessing at the direction toward the other shore, he struck out, blind. For the smoke was a curtain which shut off visibility beyond a few feet ahead. Swimming warmed Lawson, although it was hard to fight off the numbing effects of the water. As he drew away from the shore, the smoke lessened. A veer in the breeze gave a glimpse of the terrible destruction being wrought in this beautiful, virgin forest. Now and then the whimsical wind, which came in intermittent gusts, would clear a path through the smoke clouds, like a curtain being rolled back, and Lawson could see a surprising distance. Once he caught sight of tall cliffs, against whose dark, frowning faces the hellish reflection from the fire played and flickered like lightning. As realization of what that meant came to Lawson, he stopped swimming and trod water, pondering. Black Canyon Wall, hell's bells. I bet Slade is gone and trapped himself. He didn't know that the wall was ahead when he started that fire, and that he couldn't climb that rock face. Figured he'd get me, but he's going to fry himself instead. The realization of Slade's fatal error brought no triumph or satisfaction to Jim Lawson. This wasn't the way he wanted the thing to turn out. Vengeance rightfully belonged to him, not to this fire. Slade, crowded against the unscalable rock wall by the fire as it crept upward, had perished by his own inadvertence. He'd won out, for he had outwitted Jim Lawson and escaped. Lawson tried to fight off the feeling of disappointment that engulfed him. Fate, it seemed, had played him a scurvy trick. Then came another break in the smoke ahead. A new sense of uneasiness filled him. The fire had by now swept entirely around the lake. There was no hope of escape that way. Lawson hesitated, debating what to do. To return to the shore would mean slow death in the smoke. It was much thicker along the water's edge than out here in the lake, but the water was too cold to endure for long. Already his leg muscles were beginning to cramp. Bart Slade had triumphed again. Not only had he escaped retribution, but he was going to kill Jim Lawson. Then, in his black moment of hopelessness, Jim Lawson heard sharp, clopping sounds in the water to his left. He faced that way, and presently, out of the murk, came a half-grown elk that swam with a high, splashing stroke. The elk gave no heed, holding steadily to a course that cut across the one Jim Lawson had taken. The woods sense of the man came uppermost. "Where's that calf going?" he asked himself. "Looks like he knows what he's about. Maybe he's plumb foolish when he ain't scared, but not now." The young elk disappeared, and Jim Lawson swam strongly in the direction the creature had gone. He put more effort into his strokes. The elk was a strong swimmer, and Lawson didn't want to get too far behind. He could hear the steady splashing in the smoke ahead, but he could not gain on the calf. Then the splashing stopped abruptly, a puzzling thing, but Lawson kept on. Out of the smoke there loomed trees that overhung the water. Lawson first thought that he had reached the opposite shore of the lake, but he saw no fire, though he knew the body of water was surrounded by flame. He kept on hopefully, reached the trees, and found firm ground under his feet. As he dragged himself gratefully from the water, shaking with chill, he knew that he had landed on a little island. Then he remembered having seen it when he passed the lake the previous day. That fact had escaped him when he reached water after that terrifying dash through the burning woods. But the elk calf evidently knew all about the island and, gifted with inherent resourcefulness, had struck out for that place when all the other sanctuary had been swallowed by fire. Lawson saw the youngster standing a few paces off beneath the sweeping limbs of a cedar. The calf eyed him curiously, but with no sign of fear. A purring whine made the deputy look around sharply. Just to the left, a female bobcat with a kitten in her mouth, probably the only one of her babies that she had been able to rescue, gave the man a warning. But the gray-brown haunter of wilderness glooms, ordinarily the shyest of creatures, made no effort to leave. Nor did she threaten Lawson, after warning him that she would not permit him to molest her or her young. A little farther on was a she-bear and her cub. The bear stared at the man impassively, but the cub, big ears perked forward comically, looked as though he would like to investigate this strange newcomer who walked on two legs instead of four. From beneath coverts, other creatures regarded Lawson without misgivings. He saw three deer, another black bear, several foxes, a pair of raccoons. Lying draped along a limb was a great lynx, topaz eyes glowing in the light from the ring of fire about the lake. All were quiet, waiting. They showed no uneasiness at the presence of one another. Neither were they alarmed that man, the greatest destroyer of all, had come among them. Jim Lawson understood. He knew that there had been vouchsafed to him one of the rarest moments of the wild, when all the ancient hates and fears had been temporarily buried. It made him feel strangely humble. "Thunder," he breathed, "if you folks can keep a truce, so can I." Hardly had he voiced the thought when his throat tightened. Lying half hidden behind a log was a monstrous, shaggy body, which he had believed to be a brush-covered stump. But now the thing moved, and Lawson saw a round, moon-like face, a silverish muzzle, small eyes set wide apart. Slowly his breath exhaled in realization that here was the king of them all, a giant grizzly. In such close quarters this monarch of the hills was dangerous. Nothing on the island could face him and live. Jim Lawson stood frozen with apprehension, ready to dash for the lake again if the grizzly made a threatening move. But the mighty ruler of the wild, evidently, was in a benignant mood. He too was observing the truce. He had no fear. He regarded the man with little interest. It struck Larson that all these wild creatures seemed to feel that he, as they, understood and would keep the truce. For the first time in his life, the man had a sense of inferiority, a feeling that he was nowise superior to these wilderness folk, that they were honoring him in assuming that he would not break the spell which lay upon them like a sacred moment. Abruptly, he saw the gaze of the wild creatures shift toward the other end of the little island. Lawson heard nothing, but realized that their ears were keener than his. He saw that they were suddenly disturbed. Their attitude of mutual peace had vanished. Once more they were alert, on guard against threatening danger. He felt their uneasiness, without understanding the reason. There came to his ears a splashing sound in the brush, a grunt of satisfaction, the startling snap of a dry stick breaking. Then from the water and fringing willows emerged a man, Slade. As motionless as any of the wild creatures, though his brain was a maelstrom of cross impulses, Lawson watched. Slade came nearer, noisily, water dripping from his clothes. Lawson guessed what had happened. After starting the fire and finding himself trapped, the outlaw had managed to get around a point of the advancing blaze. He must have known of this lake and island. The lake was the only refuge within miles, and there was but one island. What made Lawson marvel was that Slade had survived at all. He and Bart Slade had come together at last. But it was not the moment of which Jim Lawson had dreamed. He was unarmed, whereas Slade had a six-shooter stuck in his belt. There raced through Lawson's mind a whimsical thought. Would Bart Slade understand the situation? Would he keep the truce? Lawson asked no odds of him. All he wanted was an even break, any break for that matter. But not here, not here and now. At that instant, Bart Slade saw the deputy. The outlaw ripped out a surprised oath, and his right hand flew to his gun. The weapon leaped to Jim Lawson's middle, an easy shot because Slade was only a few feet distant. The fact that Lawson did not move, but stood calmly with hands at his side, evidently puzzled the killer, for he did not press the trigger. Then he saw that the deputy was without a weapon. A grin of pleased satisfaction came to Slade's stubble-covered face. The left corner of his mouth drew up in a sneer of triumph. He wagged his head.
"Lawson," he snarled, "I've been afraid of you. Couldn't shake you off my trail. Seemed like you're some sort of human bloodhound. You know this country better than I do. But now, I could kick myself for worrying about you for even a moment. I figured the fire'd get you, but this way suits me better. I'm gonna squeeze this gun, and you're gonna feel this first slug. Like as not, you won't feel the others. Then I'm gonna fan out of this country as soon as the fire burns out. This world is gonna think that the blaze killed both us. Nobody but me will ever know what happened."
His chuckle was low, evil. "And you..." But he broke off as his eyes fell upon the wild creatures regarding him suspiciously from every covert. For an instant he wavered, then courage came back, yet his eyes were still wide with astonishment and uneasiness. Lawson saw his reaction and laughed. "Witnesses," he exclaimed softly. "They know what you've got in mind, Slade. They can spot a killer soon as they see him. They don't like you, Slade. Notice there's no wolves on this island? These wild critters don't like wolves. They know that a wolf can't be trusted, that he's a killer first, last, and always. In their eyes, you're a wolf, Slade." But the outlaw was regaining his confidence.
"Trying to scare me, Lawson? Well, you're barking up the wrong snag."
He grinned as the thought came to him, and his eyes lighted with a devilish twinkle.
"Say," he exclaimed, "this gets better and better. Know what I'm going to do? I'm going to shoot you so you'll live a while. Then I'm going to pull out and let these here wild critters finish you off. Smell of blood will stir 'em up. That she-bear with her cub looks plenty mean right now."
"Behind you, Bart!" The outlaw swung half around at the warning. What he saw made his jaw sag and drove him backward involuntarily. But the outlaw was regaining his confidence.
"Trying to scare me, Lawson?"
Until that moment, he had not apparently seen the huge grizzly. At the sound of the men's voices, perhaps the tones conveyed a meaning as plain as words, the shaggy old monarch had stirred. The hint of battle in the air was a challenge to his might, his sovereignty. For the moment, he was no longer a king willing to keep truce with his neighbors. He was a formidable beast who was cornered by men, the arch enemy. The spell was broken. The grizzly was going to betake himself elsewhere, or, if necessary, fight. Slowly the grizzly rose from behind the log, his vast bulk ominous. He muttered his displeasure with a rumble that came from deep within his chest. Jim Lawson, the hillman, understood what the great Silvertip had in mind, but Slade misinterpreted it. As he saw it, the grizzly was about to attack. The outlaw's nerves gave way like the snapping of a thread. The menacing silence which hung over the island was broken by the clapping reports of Bart Slade's six-shooter. Jim Lawson saw the grizzly flinch, saw blood spurt from wounds in the shaggy chest. The next instant, the air was filled with the vengeful roar of the aroused beast. Bellowing hatred of the man who had wounded him, the giant lurched forward in an overwhelming rush. No mere six-gun could stop the power that lay in his tremendous muscles. With speed born of desperation, Bart Slade, given no chance to run, sent his last bullet crashing into that ponderous body before he went down under the weight of it. Only for an instant did the grizzly pause. Then he caught sight of Lawson. But the latter was running for water, and all about him milled other wild creatures, panicky at the realization that the king of all was bent on destruction. The deer whistled alarm as they plunged into the lake. The black she-bear and her cub galloped to the far end of the island and the others scattered. Only the cats had opportunity to spring into the lower limbs of trees, where they climbed to safety. Jim Lawson swam with nervous strokes, putting distance between him and the island as quickly as possible. It was not beyond the bounds of possibility that the grizzly would follow him into the water, but it was more likely that the giant would go back to wreak further vengeance on the human killer who had wounded him, who had violated one of the sacred laws of the wilderness, who had broken the truce which is invoked only when Red Death rides through the forest. If he had had a gun, Jim Lawson might have faced the grizzly, though only the most accurate shooting could stop the enraged beast now. Yet Lawson wanted nothing more than to get away from the island, which, peaceful sanctuary, but a brief while before, was now a place of death where old killing impulses had been aroused and left to vent their fury. Nothing could have saved Bart Slade from the consequences of his act. The hand of fate had struck at him for his ruthlessness in firing the woods and destroying the harmless folk. He had flouted not only the laws of man, but the law of the wilderness folk. Fate had exacted her grim penalty. Jim Lawson swam on. He heard the roaring of the grizzly behind him and shuddered at what was happening. Old Pete Drain was avenged, and so was the prospector whom Bart Slade had killed. But Jim Lawson felt curiously free of any feeling of triumph. His own desire for revenge now seemed petty, as though it was something of which he should be ashamed. On shore, the fire was burning itself out. The smoke was still thick, and Jim Lawson knew he had an ordeal ahead if he would live. But something told him that he would live. Nothing in the future could surpass the terror of the immediate past. And that was Broken Wilderness Truce by Kenneth Gilbert. Thank you for joining us once again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.